I'm Andrew Tuck, and you're listening to a very special episode of The Urbanist on Monocle 24, because we're kicking off the new year with the very best from the past one.
The first time I travelled to Amsterdam to visit a friend, it soon became clear that when it comes to cycling, the Dutch do things a little differently.
Yes, it's a look back at the best tall stories from the year gone by, including a sculpture, a refreshing dip, and the joys of cycling in a European capital. All that and much, much more in the next 30 minutes with me, Andrew Tuck. Stay tuned. So, welcome to this week's Urbanist. As the new year starts, and I hope you're feeling good, we decided to take a look back at some of the very best episodes of Tall Stories, not only for fun, but for some inspiration too. And we're going to start in Canada, where back in March, our bureau chief in Toronto, Thomas Lewis, took us to Montreal to assess the significance of two bronze statues of two pet pooches that speak to the city's past divisions and the promise of a unified future.
On the 30th of October 1995, voters in Quebec turned out in record numbers to vote on the province's independence from Canada.
The day began with the polls calling the outcome too close to call, and no one dared predict the outcome until almost all the votes were counted.
A nation of 28 million holding its breath. The streets of Montreal were empty tonight. Everybody at home glued to the television, watching the numbers as they fell, and what numbers they were.
The anti-separatist vote won by a whisker. Less than half a percentage point of the overall vote between the two sides meant that Quebec would remain a part of Canada, and that sovereignty for the province, which was voted for by nearly half of the 4.7 million Quebecers who cast their ballots that day, would have to wait.
Le Canada ne chie pas sur le Québec.
The significance of the vote and the story it tells about Quebec today is still something of a contested talking point. What kind of legacy did the knife-edge vote and the years of separatist sentiment it crowned leave across the province and on its major city, Montreal? For some, it meant economic decline, the evaporation of Montreal's place as Canada's economic centre to Toronto. For others, it meant a rejuvenation in the way the city saw itself, bringing a younger, more creative crowd in across the city's threshold, making it, in many ways, the country's creative hub. Well, the answer perhaps lies in two of the newer additions to Montreal's fine collection of public art. A pair of bronze statues that stand in the heart of the city's old quarter, called the English Pug and the French Poodle. The statues are of a caricatured man and a woman, standing, facing away from each other, at either end of the plinth at the base of the imposing tower of the Banque Nationale building in the historic Place d'Armes town square. The woman is smartly dressed and is wearing a jaunty hat. Her nose is pointed firmly in the air. She stands tall, staring at the grand, domed, neoclassical edifice of the original National Bank building, often a symbol of the Anglophone presence in Quebec and its role in the colonisation and economic development of the province. Her back is turned towards the other statue. A man, dressed finely with a bulbous bronze bow tie around his neck, who's staring in the other direction, facing the grand neo-Gothic edifice of the Notre-Dame Basilica, the most potent symbol of Catholicism in Quebec and therefore an intrinsic symbol of French life in the city too. He, then, symbolises Quebec's francophone community. She, the province's anglophones. Both statues, looking away from one another, have their long, caricatured noses pointed in the air, haughtily, each figure expressing a clear and palpable distaste for the other. But the suspicion, the animosity, and disdain encapsulated by the man and the woman are disarmed by the little creatures in the arms of both. In the grasp of the woman is a French poodle. In the arms of the man is an English pug. And each dog is looking at the other as their owners turn away in disdain. Each dog, it seems, wants to play, to meet, to frolic in the company of the other. The The statues were unveiled in 2013 and are the works of the Montreal-born artist Marc-André Fortier. Had they been created any earlier, some say, there would have been riots in the streets. But not today. Sensitivities between Montreal's two halves have softened dramatically in the 20 years or so since the 1995 referendum. And there's an optimism to the city today. Its economy is blossoming, its tech sector is becoming the envy of the country, and its artistic classes are continuing to throng here. Fortier, the sculptor, has had fun with the idea that minds can change over time. The pointed, haughty noses on the faces of the figures are strapped on with what looks like a cord, meaning perhaps that our prejudices and dislikes are never permanent, that we can remove them if we have the will to do so. So if the story of Montreal's Anglophones and its Francophones only 30 years ago was one of distance and even active suspicion, today it's one of enthusiastic curiosity, of the promise of what a city shared rather than divided might offer. And it's that curiosity and that energy that's captured in the playful bronze sculptures of two eager little dogs, each intrigued by the other, desperate to meet. That's the story of the English pug and the French poodle in the heart of Old Montreal.
The New York Daily News is no longer headquartered on East 42nd Street, but the Daily News building still stands as a shining Art Deco tribute to the art of the newspaper. And while its designer left an indelible mark on the city, to many outside observers, the building might be more familiar as the workplace of a certain mild-mannered reporter. His monocle's Ben Rylan.
It's an evening like any other outside 220 East 42nd Street in Midtown Manhattan. A young, mild-mannered journalist is just leaving the office for the day, exiting through the Daily News building's shimmering brass revolving door. As he strolls along the busy sidewalk, he notices a little more chaos and commotion than usual. And everyone's eyes appear to be gazing up at the sky, fixed upon not a bird and not a plane either. The young reporter glances up at the peak of the news building to find a helicopter dangerously perched at the roof's edge, with a young woman dangling precariously from her seatbelt. He makes a swift dash for the revolving door and, in a flash and a blur, transforms himself into the Man of Steel, Superman.
Easy, miss. I've got you.
You've got me? Who's got you?
Before it was immortalized on the screen in 1978's Superman as the headquarters of Clark Kent's fictional newspaper, The Daily Planet, New York's Daily News building had stood proudly for nearly 50 years as one of the city's most spectacular monuments to the craft of journalism. When plans for the building were put in place in the late 1920s, architect Raymond Hood had already won acclaim for his 1924 design of Chicago's Tribune Tower, which is still today home to that city's newspaper. That same year, he began work on New York's American Radiator building, with a design that was, ironically, based upon Eliel Saarinen's unsuccessful bid for the Tribune Tower. Back then, this section of Manhattan was fairly unpopular, and few ambitious architects would have seen the chance to develop a skyscraper here as prime opportunity. But the Daily News had just surpassed 1 million in circulation, and they needed somewhere to house all those noisy printing presses. Today, approaching the Daily News building on foot isn't too dissimilar to how it might have been during its golden age. A short walk from Grand Central Terminal, the Chrysler Building, and the United Nations headquarters, stepping inside the news building's revolving door is to visit the grand, optimistic age of newspaper journalism. Strike a Superman pose and peer up at the sky. You might first notice an ornamental mural depicting an awe-inspiring skyscraper reaching for the heavens, atop a line of text that reads, "He made so many of them." Part of a quote attributed to Abraham Lincoln. Look higher still and you'll spot the many windows affixed with dark, contrasting panels below a series of Art Deco details. But gazing all the way up to the building's peak might at first provoke confusion. It does appear suspiciously shorter than in the 1978 film. That's because, through the alchemy of optical effects, the height of the building was doubled in the film, adding extra drama to Superman's first reveal during that famous helicopter sequence. A closer look at some of the shots reveal traces of the movie's trickery. Interior scenes of the Daily Planet's lobby were actually shot here too. The world's largest indoor globe still moves in its eternal rotation, hovering above a series of glass panels depicting the distance between the Earth, Sun, and stars. Dotted throughout this internal solar system, we also find wind speed measurements, thermometers, and other scientific curiosities illustrating the wonders of our world. The Daily News may no longer be based here, but Raymond Hood's sense of wonder and curiosity never ceased. His next project took him higher still with the majestic Rockefeller Center, though he sadly passed away before its completion. But his legacy, well, that still lingers throughout the streets of New York. You need only look up.
Up next, we're going to take a look at a humble piece of urban furniture, the Garden Gate. As London softens at its western edges and drifts like snow into suburbia, there are gentle shifts in the architecture of the capital. These gear changes may be subtle, but as you rattle out of London by train, say, or look through the dusty windscreen of your car, you do see and feel them. 30 minutes after leaving central London, you are still in London, but it's a place that has little to do with the London of our minds. All of a sudden, you've gone from stuccoed grandeur to terrace to dinky apartment blocks to semi-detached and bungalows. It's a world where echoes of rural life are felt, or at least imitated. The odd bandstand, a villagey high street, even a parish church. It's in this world that my aunt has lived her life until a couple of months ago, when the creeping vines of dementia made it no longer possible for her to remain living alone, despite all the care agencies and family offering support. It was time to leave. The house had to be packed up, but this tall story is not about her, or her life, or her home, or the amazing garden gone astray like her mind. It's a smaller thing, seemingly inconsequential, but oddly indelible. A garden gate. The garden gate only begins to make an appearance as you leave the city, and even here is increasingly rare as homeowners strip out their front gardens and have them tarmacked over to provide space to park their SUVs and various family members' polished motors. But age and a love of flowers meant that this fate would not befall my aunt's garden. I've been coming to this house all my life, and as a kid, I remember jumping out of my parents' car to push that gate open. Its modest click letting me have access to my aunt, her laugh, her world, and later, her hoarding. For many years, she also lived here with my grandmother, and that click of the gate also gained you access on a summer's afternoon to biscuits and orange squash. My dad and his sister would often trail around the garden discussing what needed pruning and replanting, this plant passion a shared bond. Over the years, I've been to that house so many times, and every visit always starts at that gate, and you always have the same feeling. You're leaving the street behind and entering a very private world. A few weeks ago, I went back for what would be the final time. My aunt was gone, the house packed up and ready to be sold. I spent some hours there with my sisters, boxing up a life. But it was the final closing of the gate that stays with me. It was the closing of so much. But it did make me realise how much I like this soft underbelly of London, where lives can be lived even now with this mix of country and city. And how much I like a gate, whose click can trigger images of summers past, makes a slideshow of lives slipping away. In June, Monocle's senior editorial team was dispatched to Zurich to polish what would become the Monocle Summer Weekly newspaper, which I'm sure you caught at the newsstands. It was also an opportunity for our business editor, Matt Alagaya, to see the city under a different light, in a trip that he described as different from any other that had come before.
OK, I have to come clean. Until last week, I didn't really get Zurich. The city has always appeared in Monocle's annual Quality of Life survey, our index of the top 25 most livable cities in the world. In fact, I can reveal that it's also made it into 2017's ranking, out later this week in the July-August issue. Still, even with that ringing endorsement in mind, I never really understood myself what all the fuss was about. I've been to Switzerland's largest city several times and have always had a pleasant enough time. It's clean, safe, salubrious. But it has always felt a touch joyless as well. Too clean to have much grit, too safe to have much of an edge. I've always found it to be a bit aloof too, particularly when compared to a warm and welcoming city like Lisbon, for instance. But last week I was forced to admit the error of my judgment. The crucial factor that I'd always missed? Simple. It was summer. Every other time I've been to Zurich, it's been the wrong side of September or the bleaker side of May. There's been a chill in the air, clouds in the sky, and no reason to linger outdoors. Last week, though, we were treated to a glorious June day. The sun was out and the mercury hit 28 degrees. Along with a few colleagues, I wandered down from our office on Nordstrasse to the Flussbad, the river swimming pool, Obere Letten. What a difference a few months make. Here was the shimmering, crystal-clear water of the Limmat River. Here were healthily tanned bodies drying off in the sun, and yet more bobbing downstream on the gentle current, some with their belongings in a dry bag, using the stream as a cheap and cheerful form of urban transport. Here were students working on laptops and office workers on extended lunch breaks. Here were beers and bratwurst on the decking, and laughter and cigarette smoke carried off on the breeze. Of course, this is why you'd want to live here. This being Switzerland, the whole setup was wonderfully efficient and civilized. Swimmers can rent clean towels and get dressed in pristine changing rooms. There's a small lending library for those who have come down and forgotten their favorite paperback. And ashtrays, fashioned out of aluminium tins, can be borrowed from a shelf, provided they're eventually returned. Yet the Flussbad also reveals an aspect of a uniquely Swiss view on life. That is, a mild disdain for nanny state-style interventions. In other cities, you know who you are, such an experience would have been hindered by rules and regulations, by whistles and warning signs. Here, however, in typically Swiss libertarian style, the authorities trust you largely to look after yourself and your fellow citizens too.
Blue skies all the way. We laugh, we joke, we sing. What a beautiful day. Not a cloud in our sight. It's such an adventure, my baby, you and I.
Nobody in a high-vis jacket shouted at anyone to stop running. There were no signs pointing to a grim smoking area, and the barman didn't prevent you from taking your glass off the premises. Again, I had to admit I was impressed. Yes, perhaps Zurich is a bit too clean and safe, and no, perhaps there isn't quite enough grit and edge here. But really, what more can you ask for from your city than a swim in the bracing water of the Limmat, a bit of decking for soaking up the sun, and to be left alone to enjoy it in peace?
What's the first thing that you do when you arrive in Amsterdam? No, not that. If you follow the advice of Monocle's very own Eileen Goffin, you should get yourself a granny bike. Adopt the upright position and take control of the road. Here she is.
Call me naive, but as a Flemish-speaking Belgian, I thought it was safe to assume that the Dutch and I would have plenty in common. Beyond a border, history and language, it's true that we also share a love of bicycles. From a young age, we pedal our way to independence. I was 6 when I made my first solo journey to school. However, the first time I travelled to Amsterdam to visit a friend, it soon became clear that when it comes to cycling, the Dutch do things a little differently. As I confidently mounted my bike at Centraal Station, I wasn't prepared for what lay ahead. Almost immediately, I was manoeuvred to the side by an overtaking cyclist. I was struck not only by the bravado of the Dutch cyclists, but also that of my usually demure friend. With a bluster I had never witnessed, she cleared herself a path with voice and bell. I know that's the purpose of a bell, but in Belgium it's considered impolite to actually use it. And as we whisked past unsuspecting tourists, I caught glimpses of their flabbergasted faces. 10 minutes later, we arrived. No dawdling, this was serious work. It's taken a few trips, but I think I finally cracked cycling in the city. It's a thrilling experience to be part of a swarm of starlings, moving as if choreographed, crossing busy junctions, navigating our way through the city, weaving between cars and pedestrians. It may seem like chaos to the onlooker, but to the participants, it's highly organized. Perhaps the key to success is the Dutch granny bike. It may weigh a ton, but its design ensures that your posture is regimental straight, which, in turn, inspires a new level of confidence. You feel like a royal on a horse. And if you're the queen, you don't need a helmet. Everyone else will look out for you. It sounds strange, but Dutch drivers likely grew up on a bike, so they anticipate your behavior. It's a stark contrast to the slinky Lycra pelotons in cities such as London and New York, always attempting to extract respect from motorists. In Amsterdam, it's that posture that makes you feel as if you own the road. Or maybe it's the fact that Dutch cyclists don't follow the rules follow them. I still make mistakes and it's terrifying. On one occasion, I was the first in a queue of bikes waiting at a red light. And when I realized I was about to pedal in the wrong direction, I froze. My explanation was lost in the flurry of commuters, and I received a grating concerto of bicycle bells and colorful phrases, some of which I didn't even know existed in our language. This anarchy didn't happen overnight. Cycling in the Netherlands has a history. Troops of cyclists would slow down German occupiers during the Second World War by riding in the middle of the road. But the critical change happened in the 1970s, when the government made huge investment in infrastructure. For almost every Belgian, this made the Netherlands a place of pilgrimage to visit on a cycling holiday. As a kid, I remember knowing the exact moment we crossed the border, when the bumpy road beneath our wheels turned to pristine asphalt. Some argue that Amsterdam has become a victim of its own success. Bikes now outnumber people, and if this two-wheel transport is not your thing, you might consider it, as my colleague coined it bluntly, bike pollution. But schemes for more underground and underwater bike parking are being developed, and all of this feels like a nice problem to have if you compare it to capitals where the car is still king. The health and environmental benefits of cycling are many, but beyond that, there are a few better ways to explore the city. So, when you visit Amsterdam, do as the locals do and find yourself a granny bike. Sit up straight, act confident, and don't be intimidated. You'll soon feel the thrill and blend into the rush of starlings. Just don't freeze at the lights.
And we're going to wrap up our Tool Story Grand Tour of 2017 in Finland. Back in October, Monocle writer Chiara Ramela bared all and explained to us how an Alvar Aalto-inspired sauna convinced her to dive headfirst into Helsinki's culture.
Just as a salmon swims back to where it was spawned, Italians cannot resist the urge to go to the seaside come August. The warm waters of the Mediterranean lure them in from Liguria to Sicily. The migration from city to coast is almost an instinctual necessity, not just a social habit. So when I found myself on the banks of the Baltics in the middle of a Finnish summer, I knew there was no avoiding a dip in the sea. Only one thing disagreed: my internal thermometer and its dislike of the water's temperature, hovering at an intimidating 16 degrees. Thankfully, the Finns had a solution, and that solution was the sauna, or to be more specific, the kulttuurisauna. On the very tip of Helsinki's neighbourhood of Merihaka, this squat structure, complete with minimalist round columns, had the solemnity of a temple and the whiteness of a clinic. It felt sedate, but benign. It had none of the raucous noise and the colour of Italy's bagni, but in its pleasing spareness, it looked curative. I knew it would fix me. And fix me it did. Much has been said about how Finnish saunas can help the residents get through tough winters when the sun only peeks out of the horizon for a few hours. But not enough credit goes to how much they can help us southern Europeans acclimatise to the Nordics. Getting to grips with the Finns' frosty shyness can be tough for a Mediterranean extrovert, but in a sauna, all reservations melt away. Everybody changes in a sauna. Quite literally, they strip off. There are two separate steam rooms inside Kulttuurisauna, one for women and one for men, as tradition dictates. The place is all the better for it. Leaving their clothes behind inside neat wooden lockers, visitors head into the steam room, stark bollock naked. One sat on the scorching benches, looking out of the window onto the harbour is a delicious joy. But looking at other bodies is fine too. This feeling of openness changes everything. The heat loosens up the joints and reveals a group of remarkably comfortable, sweaty people. The atmosphere remains predominantly silent, but it is very social nonetheless. When Kulttuurisauna opened in 2013, this whitewashed concrete box was the first public sauna to open in the city in more than 50 years. The architects who designed and still run Kulttuurisauna, Tuomas Toivonen and Nene Tsuboi, took inspiration from Finland's eminent Alvar Aalto in more than just their sauna's austere look. From Aalto, they also borrowed an attitude to saunas which sees them as a ritual, not just a pleasant pastime. In Finland, saunas follow unwritten rules of social etiquette, but they don't feel prescriptive. Inside Kulttuurisauna, you can't bring alcoholic drinks or take photographs. Opening hours are surprisingly narrow, from Wednesday to Sunday, 4 p.m. to 9 p.m. Yet, this small white cube is a place where it's easy to feel free, warm and welcomed in this quiet, reserved city. Its simplicity works wonders. It worked so well that it convinced me to dive headfirst into the seawater. And you know what? It really wasn't that cold after all.
And that's all for this week's episode of The Urbanist. Today's show was produced by Carlotta Ribello and it was edited by David Stevens. To play you out of this episode of The Urbanist, here's John Anderson with Tall Buildings. Thank you for listening, City Lovers. Yes, City Lovers.